complete, no problem. Ground everything real well, and you're in business, okay?
Okay, number two. My friends give me a microphone with a antenna on it for 2 meters. Now, when I talk on that, it's a Sabre 3. Now, when I talk on that, will RF get into my brain? someone told me that the RF will get into me, but I like to make, can you please make a comment on that?
Go ahead, Dick.
That's a new one on me. I've never heard that somebody made a coil core type microphone with an antenna mounted on the microphone. Is that what you're saying, Eugene? Go ahead.
Yes, this is true. Motorola made a microphone with an antenna on top of the microphone. And I'd like to know, is it safe to use for the RF not to go into my brain or anyone else or fly my brain like a fly egg? So I'll be hardboard, says Soft World. And I have the microphone, but the microphone has a 440 antenna on it, but I needed to get a 2 meter version of an antenna to go in there. It has like a long needle that goes into the microphone, but I need one that will work on 2 meters only.
I don't recommend that. I don't recommend the use of that. And you're saying that it's cooking your brain. The worst thing you've got to worry about is cooking your eyes. The most sensitive part of a human being is the optical system. And the most dangerous thing you're worried about here is creating extra heating and therefore creating a cataract. If you look at the safety section of Volume 2 of the VHF-UF handbook published by the Radio Society of Great Britain, they recommend that you hold your handy-talkie horizontal, not vertical, so that the rubber duck antenna is further away from your eyes to be safer. On top of that, I know of a man living on Long Island who many days in a row would run a 4-watt or 5-watt 450 handy-talkie while walking around his house in Nassau talking to 450 repeaters. He did that day in and day out. The handy-talkie would get hot in his hand, the batteries would go dead, he had a whole pile of batteries, he kept throwing new batteries in and kept talking. Two things happened to that man. Number one, on a number of those days of heavy use of that 450 handy-talkie, he told me that his eyes felt like they had sandpaper in them. They felt dry and irritated. Number two, a year or two later, he developed a cataract in both eyes. And we're talking about a man in his 30-year time frame. And he doesn't have a history in his family of having cataracts. So from that anecdotal evidence, a 450 or even a 2 meter rig with a rubber duck real close to your eyes, as it would be with the antenna on the microphone, I think that is not recommended. Radio-wise, it may be a handy place to keep the antenna with the rest of the radio on your belt clip. Operationally, it's a nice way to go. Safety-wise, I think you're pushing your luck, and I don't recommend it, Eugene. W2EWK, K2RIW on the TechNet.
I know what he means now, Dick.
Go ahead, give him a couple of words. Maybe I misunderstood him. I probably still got my point across, but go ahead, Mel.
What about the police walkie-talkie?
That's the one, police walkie-talkie. You see a lot of foot patrolmen, and they have the Motorola, they have the radio hangs on their belt, the microphone hangs up on the top of their lapel, and above the microphone, top of the microphone, is the antenna stick.
Okay. Now, the good news is that all of the OSHA, NIOSH, and IEEE, ANSI standards, ANSI stands for American National Standard Institute. When it comes to calculating exposure to your eyes, you must integrate for 6 minutes. The eye has a thermal time constant of roughly 6 minutes. Very similar to putting a pot of water on the stove. You can't boil it away immediately. It takes you some time. Well, it takes you some time to heat the eye. So whether or not your exposure you've given to your eye is excessive determines what you've done in any six-minute period. A ham radio operator who walks around day in and day out talking many hours on a 450 repeater, talking to his buddies, might put in hours of operation, and he was changing batteries multiple times during the day. He was grinding through all kinds of batteries. A patrolman using his radio is making extremely brief transmissions. Except for some very rare occasions, I'll be amazed if his transmission is ever more than 15 or 20 seconds, because the exposure limits are calculated for a 6-minute period. Let me just make a rough guess here. If the worst thing the patrolman ever did was to transmit for 15 seconds, which is 1/4 of 1 minute, which is 1/24th of the time that is calculated for exposure, 6 minutes, you would have to do something pretty darn bad to make that unsafe. I think you'd have to have the rubber duck pressed up against the cornea of your eye with your eye open to get you in trouble in that case. The person who asked about a patrolman, who are you, and I wonder if that gives you any comfort. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Up KA2UIJ in Lodi, New Jersey. No, I'll just comment on that because I've seen a lot of police and fire use them. But that makes sense what you mentioned about they don't really use it that well.
Yeah, because they are making extremely brief transmissions for a whole lot of reasons. I mean, anybody in law enforcement, fire, emergency, whatever, are given tremendous amounts of instruction to make sure that they're brief, their transmissions are very concise and very brief, because they want the extra airtime for other emergency traffic. They don't want you on them blabbing for 5 solid minutes about the color of the vehicles in front of you and what traffic light you're stuck at and so on. They don't want that jazz. They want extremely brief transmissions. But the other side of the coin is that you, a amateur radio operator going over a 450 repeater, if you happen to be around for many hours during the day with nothing to do, and you have some significant rag shoes where you talk for 6 minutes at a time, and let's face it, you've heard me babble on here for at least 6 or 10 minutes at a time when I get on one of my hot subjects. So if I was doing that with a handy talkie pressed up against my forehead, I would be beyond the threshold of alarm where the total exposure might be significant to my eyes. You don't have to worry anywhere near as much about your brain. Your brain has a tremendous rate of blood flow. It's got a beautiful natural cooling system. My eye does not. The rate at which fluid flows through my eye is extremely small. It doesn't have a natural cooling mechanism. And the temperatures at which my cornea can tolerate a very small delta from normal body temperature. You don't have to heat up your cornea very many degrees Fahrenheit before it starts becoming like the white of an egg. It starts becoming opaque. So, and it doesn't happen right away, unfortunately. You can have the exposure that creates the eye damage today, and you may not see the effect on the eye for a couple of days. So the cause and effect relationship telling you to stop doing it is almost not there. The strongest clue my friend had is that he was telling me that his eyes feel like they've got sandpaper in them. That was an extremely strong clue that something improper was taking place. And if you get that as a symptom, stop doing whatever you're doing and maybe go to an eye doctor and make sure everything's safe. Now, Paul wanted to give us some information. I think there's a beautiful shuttle launch about to take place where it's a nighttime launch meeting up with the International Space Station. And it's going to be a blast-off that goes along the east coast of the United States. And I think we are in a very favorable position to get a beautiful view of that rocket burn. Maybe Paul's going to be telling us something about that. I hope Paul's still there. WS2N, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, very good. Yeah, still here. And SDS 116. Oh, I'm not sure if we'll see it from Long Island. You know, it's got a 58... degree inclination. The usually when they have those, you know, 63 inclinations, we got to see them when they did they tried to, you know, go as close to a polar orbit as possible. We used to see them. I don't remember if we saw any from the Mir and the International Space Station. They're roughly the same inclination. So Don't know about that. You might have to be very far east, maybe eastern part of Maine or something. You might be able to see something. Yeah, Dick, it's December 7th, 4:15. They call it the P5 port side truss section. It's essentially a spacer, large, 14 by 14 type of truss, you know, maybe 10 feet long or so. But this thing is very important for that next eventual piece that will go out onto that truss, which will hold another solar array. So they need to install that. They're going to bring up some supplies and something called the Space Hab Logistics Module. That's located right behind the crew section. And it's accessible through a tunnel from the space shuttle. And in that they have like 3 tons of food and cargo and water and all kinds of supplies for the International Space Station. You can float into it, shirt sleeve environment, grab whatever you need, and bring it into the space station. We drive it. You said we had a timer on this thing, Dick?
Yeah, I think they may have reset things because I'm not hearing the sounds of the timer. By the way, Paul, I was on a website for NASA.gov, which did indicate each of the major cities along the eastern seaboard, what hour to look, what direction to look, how many degrees above the horizon it will be, and how long you will see it. I think we are within the range for New York City in which we are going to get a good view of the real burn. I'm not sure whether or not we're going to be able to see the major bright burn that takes place from the solid rocket booster. I'm a little bit afraid that the booster engine cutoff, BECO as they call it, might take place before it comes within our view. But the main engine of the space shuttle, which is a hydrogen oxygen fuel engine, not quite as bright a flame, it's a dimmer blue flame, still that should be very visible against a dark black sky if we happen to have a good dark sky at 4:15 this coming Thursday, December 7th. So if you go to the website of NASA.gov and you look up space shuttle, it'll tell you for each of the major cities where to look, when to look, how high to get above the horizon, and how long you'll be able to see it between, what do they call it now? Acquisition of signal and loss of signal, AOS, LOS, so to speak. This is an optical event. You'll have to choose a place where you can see all the way down to the horizon to the southeast. It's gonna pass us to the southeast, and so choose a place where you got a real good view over water or over nice clear land where there's not trees blocking you to the southeast. And I'm pretty sure it is visible from our locale, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW in the tech net.
WA2CDL information.
Go ahead, Andy.
Really good. Does anyone want to add something?
Yeah, Andy does. Go ahead, Andy.
Okay, now just sorry for what happened before. There was some technical difficulties, but we corrected it, and do we repeat this in the net mode? You won't have any problem with timers or announcements or things of that nature. That's been corrected. Thank you, Dick, WHCDL.
Very fine, Andy. And as you know, we have a brand new repeater, and some of the getting used to functions are still taking place on that new repeater controller. Go ahead, Paul, with anything else you want to tell us about the space environment. And too bad I didn't have that information all printed out for us here in the New York City area. But I'm almost positive we will be able to see STS-16. WS2N, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, very good. Well, let's see. It's going off at 4:15. 6 minutes is when we would see it. So figure 4:21, look in that direction. And I've seen it before, so again, when it's dusk or just getting dark, it's the best time. It'll be worth looking for Oswego occurs at 8 minutes, so it's just past our latitude when the main engine occurs, and then soon after that they drop off the external tank. That should be very, very good. When the shuttle goes up, the first 2 minutes, solid boosters come off, but then 4 minutes later, you'll have the, it should be passing us, and then 2 minutes after that, you cut off and you drop the tank, the external tank.
0, 1, 4.
So look for that, and I'll definitely keep that in mind. This mission is, like I said, quite tense. In the shuttle cargo bay, behind the space habitat logistics module, you have the T5 spacer that they're going to install, and then behind that you have they call it an integrated cargo carrier, which carries all the equipment for the external things that are going to be done, all the EVAs, the equipment that they use for the EVAs is all located in that area. So they'll be doing three spacewalks. The main project for the spacewalk is going to be the rewiring, we call the rewiring of the International Space Station. If you've seen pictures of the space station, they have the P6 solar array. That's the original one that's been up there above the center of the space station. That's temporary. They call it a P6 for a reason. It's a port 6 solar array that will eventually be relocated to the port side. You have the main, called the fuselage, going down, which carries the Destiny module. It carries the Unity lab. It carries Zarya. It carries Vesta, the living quarters of the Russian compartment. So that's the ball in line, and then running on it adjacent to that would be this truss section. Off the truss section, they'll have all these solar panels coming off of it. But temporarily, they've had this P6 one mounted above the Unity module, and the way that's located, that's only temporary. So this is like going from temporary light in a building to permanent light. They want to rewire the space station. They've been running off this temporary solar panel, which will eventually be moved to the port side. The last mission that went up, they put this other solar panel in its proper location on the truss section. This solar panel that's there has to be able to rotate, and it actually has to rotate 360 degrees, and that will be doing that every 90 minutes when it's fully operational. They need to follow the sun as this thing goes around in orbit. In fact, all sets of the solar arrays, you can have two big sets on one side and two big sets on the other side. Right now you have the one main set that's up there that's temporary. You have the last set that was brought up. There's two more just like that that are planned to eventually go up to be mounted on this long truss assembly that's been being built for the last who knows how many years. So they've got to disconnect the power from the T6 and then replug these plugs in to power up the new panels that were put up there last time. They install the panels, but they're not powered up. These guys are going to do that. So you've got a, for instance, it's 12 days. It's first day is launch, second day, they're going to check out the orbiter like they have in the last few missions with the external Canada arm, the robotic arm, which will inspect the outside of the orbiter, make sure they don't have any debris hits from the external tank. The next day, they're going to do the standard backflip that they've been doing the last couple of times they visited the International Space Station, where their crew could take pictures, make sure there's no damage. Zanita Williams, one of the astronauts on board, she'll officially join the International Space Station crew. She's going to be replacing Thomas Reeder, who's been up there for a while. He'll be coming back on the on the shuttle. They're dropping her off. They're going to bring him back. That same day, when they do the backflip, they're going to use the combination of the different robot arms, the one on the shuttle and one on the International Space Station, to remove the T5 spacer that's stowed in the cargo bay of the shuttle. Get ready to install that. Next day, you've got the first EVA. They're going to go out and actually install that, bolt everything up to the T5 truss section, which will be installed along that whole truss array. And then next day, they'll be out. A very important part of the mission is to retract this P6 solar array. It's extended some, 300 feet or something. I think it's 240 feet right now. They've got to retract it, bring it back, fold it up, which right now it's in the way. If they left it out, they'd never be able to rotate the new solar panels that are up there that are also 250 feet long. Right now, the way it's set, it would hit the sector, it would hit them. They have to fold that up, leave that folded up. Eventually, that will be shifted to the end of the truss section. You might say, well, what happens if something goes wrong? There's actually a plan to eject this thing, to get rid of it, and let it deorbit, bring up another one if things go wrong. Hopefully, they don't have to do that. It's been like $100 million or something. So that's the plan for that. And then the next day, they're going to go out on another EVA to start the rewiring process, which involves unplugging and plugging in connectors. They'll have a ball with that. That should go pretty well. The thing that they're worried about is retracting the solar array. It's been out there for, 5-6 years, heating and cooling, a 400-degree swing between hot and cold. Will it retract? They're going to find out. This was planned. It's not like an afterthought. So maybe, it should go good. We'll see. Next day, they'll have a news conference. Another day after that, they do another EVA to continue rewiring the International Space Station. And next day is a little easier for them. They're just going to move the mobile transporter unit. That's a little train car that runs along eventually 300-foot truss section. And they'll send that down to the starboard side. This way, it's a get-ready motion, to get ready for the next mission. They'll need to have the station robot arm mounted to that to eventually continue to build the station on the starboard side. And then they'll undock. They'll do a fly around the space station. The next day, they'll have another inspection of the orbiter, make sure everything's all okay with the heat shields and all their tiles. And then they'll probably have a conference, the next day is like a day off. And then they'll have a landing officially on day 13. You've got Commander Mark Polsky. He'll be the commander. You've got the pilot. Pilot is William Opaline, and two EVA specialists, Robert Kruppern and Krista Begel. I can't pronounce his name. Begley Sang, I think it is. There'll be the EVA, three EVAs for them on this flight. And you've got Joan Higginbottom. She'll be doing the robotic arm as a mission specialist. Another mission specialist, Nicholas Patrick. And you've got two flight engineers, the one they're bringing up, they're going to leave off, a woman, Danita Williams, and they'll be bringing back Thomas Ryder. He'll be returning on the space shuttle. So that's it, Dick. We'll leave the planets and the galaxy alone for this week, and we'll turn it back to Ned. This is WS2N.
So I think we should keep track of what the NASA site is telling us and the news reports are telling us as to whether or not this mission goes off as planned on Thursday, 4:15 in the afternoon. Something that just occurred to me from what you were speaking about, that is, the space shuttle goes around the Earth once every approximately 90 minutes, hour and a half. Therefore, it makes 16 orbits per day. If the solar panels are tracking the sun continuously, as the shuttle itself keeps its orientation
with reference to the Earth's surface constant. That means the rotary joint on the solar panels is making 16 complete rotations per day, if I didn't get that wrong. And assuming that the solar panels are producing something like 100 amperes of current, I've now got 100 amperes flowing through a rotary joint, sliding finger stock, or something like that, making 16 complete revolutions per day, which is 5,840 revolutions per year. That sounds like a lot of wear and tear on those rotary joints. Rotary joints like that, properly designed with gold-plated contacts, just carrying very weak signals, 5,000 operations, no problem. But carrying 100 amperes, wow. I wonder, am I wrong in my assumptions here, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, if you take a look at the rotary joint that they brought up last time, that was on the P3 and P4 section, I think it was. Joint itself, I mean, it's like the size of a Volkswagen. It's a big freaking joint. Now, what's incorporated inside that, I'd like to see. I don't know. Could imagine these slip rings, you know. I don't know what they got going on in there. But my guess is probably two slip rings, you know. It definitely comes in D.C., so it's not like any break in the action. Can you imagine these, sort of using big brushes on the inside of this thing to run along it? I really don't know. I've never studied it that closely. But, that's what they'll do. They'll rotate. They're not doing it yet, of course. The one that's permanently mounted really isn't moving. They can roll the array right now. They're going to be able to move in two axes. Right now, the one that's up there just moves in moving one axis. Eventually, when they're mounted, now you've got, you know, it's going to look like four solar arrays on one side and four solar arrays on the other. Each solar array section is actually like two solar arrays. You know, so that when they put it up, it's like two of them. So they'll be rotated on this joint. The two on the end, on the port side, will rotate, or, you know, together with one joint. And the same on the starboard side when this thing is completed. And the amount of amperage going through, I used to know the numbers, how much power to put in. I forgot what, 20,000, 20 kilowatts, yeah, I think 20 kilowatts each or something. I think each one. And when you go in, they run it, you get DC out of it, and they do have converters that actually run AC. A lot of the motors, the rotary joint included, are AC motors. Believe it or not, you think, oh, why not DC? But they run AC. The reason for it is the three-phase hookup. They can have lighter motors, more reliable. If one phase goes down, you'll still be able to move the joint. If the DC motor goes, you know, quits at the end of that. So that's why they opt for a lot of the motors on the space station and all these things. Shuttle and everything are all three-phase operation motors. People don't realize that. I think the standard voltage is 28 volts for a lot of the equipment on board that they do use. So, whatever they have up there now operating, right now it's like 25% of what eventually they'll have. They'll eventually have online three more of these solar arrays, so they'll have a tremendous amount of power. Plus this one that's up there, of course, not looking at the sun all the time. When they have these things rotating on a regular basis, you're going to have not only four times the amount of power, but you'll have it for maybe, you know, two or three times more, you know, per day, or per a period of time, because they'll be facing the sun, like, you know, on a regular basis. Back to you.
if I was trying to pass 100 or 200 or 300 amperes through a rotary joint, I would have real trouble making it last multiple years, 5,840 revolutions per year for multiple years. I mean, 100 amperes is approximately the current you've got flowing through the brushes of your starter motor, of your rotomobile. And you know darn well you couldn't run that starter motor brush-wise continuously for a year. You and I use that starter motor for a couple of seconds at a time, three times per day. And if we're real lucky, it lasts 5 years. So now, I'm slowly concluding, Paul, that they must have a induction-conduction. In other words, the power on the solar cells is going to a high-frequency inverter. That, in turn, is going to a primary winding, but the stator. The secondary winding is the rotor on the center of the hub. And so, if they're real smart, that could be both the motor that powers the positioning of the solar panels, and it could be a contactless power transformer between the solar panel and the rest of the International Space Station. If I get a chance, I'm going to look into that. I'm having great trouble believing, no matter how sturdy is the design of those brushes, you couldn't put that many amperes through there day in and day out and have it survive. I hate to send the astronauts out there to change the brushes on the solar panels, because you know darn well it would occur at an extremely inconvenient time. I'll bet you that's a real contactless transformer. What do you think, Paul? K2LIW on the TechNet.
Yeah, well, sounds good, yeah. This way you'll have no brushes involved. I'm sitting here thinking, instead of brushes, I was saying it before, maybe they have to, like, rollers or something, big metal rollers or something, riding along the inside. Induction sounds like the way to go. I'd like to find out, I haven't heard anything on that particular situation. Very good, Dick. I can't imagine that doing service work, pulling these things out every now and then. They have backups. They'll survive on the other three arrays. No. By the way, Dick, I got a nice picture from in the astronomy magazine with the Mars Global Surveyor. So, wanted to bring that up. One of the pictures that they took down at Victory Crater, that's where the Opportunity rover is riding around right now. You can see the rover. I mean, it's small, but this thing was able to resolve that dot on the planet. So that's the new spacecraft that was just put into operation. It's been in orbit for, 6 months doing the aerobraking. But they got some pictures back already. It's unbelievable what this thing can see. I did want to mention that. I thought about that earlier in the week. But back to you, Dick. WS1.
H2KY comment.
Yeah, I think I saw that picture in my latest issue of either Sky and Telescope or Astronomy. Go ahead, Bill.
Okay, you mentioned about contactors, flippering your contactors. I went on a tour some years ago, Pennsylvania Station. Oh, they took me downstairs. It was a special tour. And down there they had rotary converters. Oh, you should have seen the size of these pieces of equipment. They were monsters. These were used before they shut them down. They haven't been used now a number of years since they went to solid state systems. But these rotary converters, during World War II, I said, gee, it's this... they're real, real hefty piece of equipment. I says that they have to, do a lot of maintenance on them and all. He said they ran the entire time of World War II, from the beginning of the war, and till the end of the war, without one breakdown. Now these things are really, produce a tremendous amount of current to run the trains in and out of that station. Now they had them guarded night and day. They had armed guards on it. Because if anything happened to those rotary converters, it could have made a big dent in the war effort, because it would have shut down the whole chunk of the Eastern Corridor, system of, you know, trains going through Penn Station and all. But, so here's rotary converters that were running, you know, with slip rings and brushes that were running for the entire 5 years of the war without stopping 24 hours a day, Dick, over.
And you're sure that the trains were running on DC, not AC, and you believe that there were slip rings and brushes conducting all of that extremely high current? Well, if you got an extremely large structure that fills up something the size of a building, you can do that. They don't have that much mass and volume in space. I'm having trouble believing that was the approach. On top of that, Mel, that rotary converter could be running in such a way where the staddle winding that gave you the DC to the tracks really was a multi-phase winding, picking up the AC and going into a set of rectifiers where there is no sliding contact, so to speak. So you're fairly sure that the output current was coming from sliding contacts on slip rings? I mean, a complete train system. I'm going to pick a number out of the air, but maybe it requires 10,000 amperes of current. I'm having trouble believing you can reliably get 10,000 amperes of current from slip rings without it eating up all the materials involved. How about you, Mel?
Oh, yeah. Definitely DC output. They had no rectifiers in those days. This is 1940 tech. Well, they were built in the 30s. They were big casted units. Huge motor, like, you know, turbine type, you would think that would be in a power plant. Basically, you know, they were, except they were driven by AC. The primaries were driven by AC, and the output is, you know, a rotary converter, AC into one side, and basically a huge dynamo. And the output, oh, the output, you could stand there and you look at the mass of the brushes. The rotary unit itself that was turning in there was like, oh, I'd say maybe a foot and a half in diameter. And each brush, you could see it was like paralleled up brushes that were on there. Each, well, I think there were, if I remember correctly counting, I think I saw five paralleled brushes. They're made out of sintered bronze. They were, I asked the material, I thought it was copper or something. He said, no, it was sintered bronze. And each one was about, may have been originally, you know, before they wore down, as they wore down, but it may have started out maybe about, maybe 4 or 5, maybe 6 inches long. And they were spring loaded. And maybe two inches in, you know, square at the head. So they were massive units, and they had a, you know, they had not one of these rotary converters. They had about, let me see, gee, was there six, I think. If I remember correctly, I think there was six of them side by side, Dick. And, yes, that supplied the DC to the system, over.
Do you believe those six rotary converters were supplying six individual circuits of the system? Or do you think somehow they were wired in series parallel combinations, Mel? Go ahead.
Well, they did have governor controls, right? Because I asked them, how do you keep the system in sync? You know, who else would ask questions like this? But I thought of it. I said, gee, you know, if you have something in imbalance, one is going to try to drag the other, make a motor out of it, you know, back and forth. And they had an elaborate mechanical system to keep them in sync. So I would assume that this was to keep be able to parallel up the outputs, over.
What city and location was this thing? That sounds to me like you saw it with your own eyes. How long ago, Mel?
Right here in New York City, Penn Station. That's went downstairs. That's the very few people know about it. It's way below ground. I don't know how much. I think it's 6 floors below New York, below the Penn Station. They had a special tour that time for engineers. And it's not generally, I don't know if it's open to the public. I don't know anymore what's the current situation. This is about 8, 9, maybe 10 years ago, Dick. I know they have tours, but I don't know if they take you on that tour as a general tour, Dick, over.
Okay, those rotary converters with their slip rings are producing the thousands of amperes at 600 volts of output to run the electric portion of the train. Where was the raw power coming from? was that coming from Con Ed, or was their own steam generator right there? Go ahead.
That was Con Ed. Con Ed had lines buried way down, huge power lines coming in. Oh, you should see the control panels. They were humongous control panels, monster switches, you know, contacted switches. And it was all from Con Ed supplied the electric power, but it was buried, nothing above ground. Everything was going through a tunnel. In fact, they said the tunnel, you could, you could, of course, with the power off, I don't know, the primary that they were supplying to them was then, going through transformers to reduce it down to 440, which the primary is on these rotary converters. Now, the tunnel that extended, the wire was actually extended in the tunnel between standoff dicks that you could actually, they said, if you could look down the tunnel, it looked like it went forever, like a subway tunnel. You couldn't get a train, you'd walk through it, I guess, if the power was off over.
What's your guess? The transformer was stepping it down to 440 volts, probably three phase, to run the rotary converters, the DC output for the tracks. But the raw input, I'm going to guess, was three phase, 13.2 kilovolts, or maybe it was even higher, like 50 kilovolts or 100 kilovolts. The higher the voltage, although it gives you a problem with providing enough insulation and the dielectric strength, still you need a lot less copper as you go to higher voltages. Any idea what the primary voltage from Con Ed was? Go ahead.
You know, I vaguely remember, I thought I remember looking at a label on there and it said 23 kV. I think I saw that. It said 23 kV. I'm pretty much sure of that. I don't know, it's been years now, but they didn't let you take any pictures or anything down there. That was the unfortunate situation. Even though it wasn't as strategic anymore, you know, as it was during World War II, like you said, the guy, there were two armed guards right at the elevator door, and if you came down without the right tasks or whatever, they had orders to shoot anybody, literally shoot them, because they said if somebody walked in there with a pail of sand, they could kill the whole system over.
KT2KSK was a comment.
KT2KSK, recognized. ASK, okay. 26 kilovolts strikes me as a possible voltage because it's all underground. You've got a compromise here between how much insulation you want to provide for higher voltages versus how much current you want to provide because the voltage isn't high enough. And you want to conduct the right number of megawatts, literally. K2KSK, start off with your name and then your question or comment, sir. My name is Dick, KQLIW.
Welcome to the W.
Ah, good evening there, Dick. It's KC2KXK, name's Keith. And just wanted to let you know that the voltage coming at the Kennedy Airport is 27 kV. So I wasn't sure if it would be the same for Penn Station. But at Kennedy Airport, Con Ed gives us 27 kV. And they have transformers there. They step it down to 4160. Back to you, Dick.
So your secondary distribution is 4160. Your primary input, 27 kilovolts to Kennedy. Sounds about right. I guess these 100 kilovolt lines are only for long-range transmission. You're essentially into the distribution area because the number of miles between you and the nearest Con Ed station is not so far. Keith, roughly how many miles to the nearest Con Ed station at Kennedy Airport? Go ahead.
I really don't know, to be honest with you. I could ask my supervisor next time I see him, and I'm sure he'd know. He's very knowledgeable with the high-tension side of the airport, since he's the high-tension coordinator.
Yeah, I would guess that Con Ed has got generating stations in all five boroughs. What do you think, Mel?
I believe they do. You know, they have the, of course, in Queens, they got that big operation. They have that Ravenswood, where Big Alice is. I guess you know the story on that one. That most likely is the supply for Kennedy Airport. I would believe that's the closest to Kennedy Airport that goes.
Okay, Big Alice is in Queens. You said, I know the story. Give us a couple of words on that. Sounds like an exciting story. Whereabouts is Big Alice?
Well, the story with Big Alice, I knew a guy, and funny, years ago, I was once in a hospital, and I shared a room with a guy who worked for Con Edison in the power plant, and we sat up a whole night just talking, and he was telling me the whole story about Big Alice and Con Ed. They called it Big Alice. It was built by the company called Alice Chalmers, the Alice Chalmers Corporation, and it was nothing but a big headache. It was a monstrous piece of equipment, of course. You know, big turbine system, and it was plagued with troubles constantly. And he said the thing literally would fly up, it was literally flying apart at times. But once they got it down to they ironed out all the headaches, that began to supply a good part of the power for Queens. That's the Ravenswood section of Queens. And Alice Chalmers Corporation lost so much money on it that they swore off it. They never built another one, Dick, over.
Okay, and for us who don't live in Queens, where is Ravenswood? How many miles in what direction from Kennedy Airport?
Let's see, Ravenswood, Queens. Let me picture how you could really picture Ravenswood, Queens. I can picture the area, and it would be most likely, maybe within a few miles of, let's see, if you go across there, I have to look at the map. I would say within 5 miles of Kennedy Airport.
Okay, it's all coming together very nicely. If I wanted to make a transmission system for 5 or 10 miles, 27 kilovolts is probably ideal. I wouldn't want to go higher than that because a great big transformer to step it all the way up, high tension lines, great big towers, great big insulators, and then another huge transformer to step it back down again, just for 5 or 10 miles, that would be a waste. These 100 kilovolt, 500 kilovolt transmission systems are what you use to go across something as big as a state, not 5 or 10 miles. So I think we pinned it all down. Okay, have I gone through all the list of people who gave me a yes, that they really did have a question? I think I did. Let me double check. KQRIW from the TechNet. I kind of thought so. So, Mel, you got the floor. Sorry we gave it to you so late, and whether or not you go any further with your instruction is strictly up to you, sir. You've got the airtime if you want to. I think you're going to become a retired man one of these days, so maybe you've got all kinds of time on your hands. K2KEY, K2IW in the TechNet.
This is K2KEY, yeah, right behind you. I think I'm about a month older or something than me, so I can say I'm behind you when you retire. It's a joke, of course, you know. But I think we're better off staying active, Dick, to tell you the truth. It's important to keep your mind, you know, constantly working so that I believe it's like a muscle. It's got to be exercised. You know, I got a lot of emails and very positive about our discussions of the Smith chart. And I got a number of them that ask about the about feed lines, about coax cables. Most of them ask me about which coax cable should I buy. If I have this radio, would you suggest I buy this cable? If I have this antenna, which cable I should buy? If I buy, have this cable already, should I buy an antenna to match it? And on and on and on and on. And again, I can't comment. If you want to know about cable, what I would suggest you do is take the ARRL antenna book as a complete table of common transmission line data. They got the names of the cable, the popular cable, the numbers of the cable, and all the particulars about the cable. And in fact, they give you things like attenuation for a given piece, usually computed, I think it's all computed, if I'm not mistaken, based on 100 feet. And it's attenuation in dB. Am I correct, Dick, over?
Sure, Ron. Most cables sold in the United States, when it comes to attenuation, they talk about decibels per 100 feet. In Europe, they usually talk about decibels per 100 meters. And although very, very few installations of a transmission line in Europe 100 meters long, which would be about 310 feet. Very, very few people run a transmission line that long. The reason why they give it to you in decibels per 100 meters is you take that number, divide by 100, and you easily know with as many decimal places as you desire how many decibels per meter. Same thing with the United States, decibels per 100 feet. 100 feet of cable is a lot more prevalent, a lot more popular. But they could give it to you decibels per 15 feet or per 33 feet, and the mathematics would come out crazy. Per 100 feet, if they tell you your cable, like say for instance RG8, ordinary RG8 polyethylene cable at 432 megacycles, is approximately 4.5 dB per 100 feet. 4.5 dB per 100 feet, move it over two decimal places, tells you it's 0.045 dB per foot. So it works out very convenient. But we do quite often run 100 feet of cable. I have. And so when you're running 100, 150, 200 feet of cable at VHF, UHF frequencies, you're not likely to use RG8. You may use an RG8 or an RG9, about the same diameter, but double shielded polyethylene. You might use that as a jumper to go around the rotator. But the main chunk of transmission line, if you're a serious VHF operator, is more likely to be hardline, half inch, 7/8 inch, 3/4 inch, inch and a quarter. And if you're a real serious moon bouncer, you'd be amazed what percentage of them are running inch and 5/8 Andrew Heliac air-filled pressurized cable or low-density foam, inch and 5/8. I think that's a couple of pounds per foot. I think we're talking about lots of dollars per foot of that cable. But it's got insertion loss of 0.45 dB per 100 feet. In other words, one-tenth the loss of RG8. The bad news is it's heavy, big, and expensive. But these serious moonbound hams, they've got contacts all over the world, literally. They know everybody of importance, and if anybody ever throws out a piece of that cable, they are Johnny on the spot. They are to pick it up immediately before it goes to the junk man. So these guys almost never are paying full list price. They got all kinds of ways of getting cable. Back to you, Mel. K2KEY, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Roger, K2KEY here. And as Dick just said, that's a total loss. And a given piece of transmission line is dependent on frequency, line length, and SWR. Okay, that's just make it simple. And, as a fact, I had a roll of cable here some years ago. A friend of mine picked up a number of rolls that was in a warehouse here that were cleaning out in Brooklyn. And the stuff had just some military designation on it, and it was coax cable, had a woven outside, not a polyethylene, which right away gave you a signal that it most likely was World War II stuff. And when we tested a piece of it, it looked like RG8U, had a woven outside and a rubber type of material underneath that, and then the braid was sort of silver plated. And then a rubber, again, rubbery type of dielectric in there behind after the braid. And then the center was twisted copper, number 10 copper twisted wire, stranded. So in checking it, I found that we had a 0.28 dB per 100 feet at 3.5 megahertz on 80 meters, 0.28 dB loss. However, for on 150 megahertz, it went to 2.65 dB per 100. So you can see the difference there. So my friend of mine in Pennsylvania put a dipole up in the woods behind his house there, a few hundred feet away, a 160-meter dipole. So I gave him a good part of the roll. It was about 500 feet of it. For 160 meters, of course, it was a perfect cable, but you wouldn't want to use that cable, of course, on 2 meters even. So I'll just give you an example, you know, how wide a different situation you can have where the cable could be perfect, more or less, for particular use that he put it to, but you wouldn't think of using it in the hundreds of feet, especially on 2 meters. Anybody have any questions before we go any further?
Those insertion loss numbers, by the way, are fairly close to the numbers you would get with RG8 or RG, I'm trying to think of the other number, can't think of it right now, for RG8. Was it approximately the diameter of RG8, about 4/10 of an inch melt?
It was RG8U, basically, I think. Most likely it was, we later on found out the guy had a number of rolls of it, finally somebody looked at it and said, oh, I know what that was for. They used it in the World War II bombers to run the communications cable for the radios with that. That was used, and the reason they used that type of covering, that silk covering, because it wouldn't slip in a harness once, you know, they used to do looming work, you remember, with the cord, that wax cord they used to loom it into the harness. So they said that this stuff wouldn't chafe or slip over.
Yeah, and the older RG8 cable that was prevalent for World War II, back when I first became a ham in the 1950s, quite a few people were sucking that stuff up for some very nice prices because it was world surplus. That's the good news. But it did have what's called the contamination problem. In other words, the outer polyethylene jacket and the inner polyvinyl chloride outer jacket and the inner polyethylene jacket, the particular materials that were used were such that some of the polymer from the outer plastic jacket would leach through the braid into the inner polyethylene, contaminated, and the net result was the cable would increase in loss faster than more modern cables. So on 80 meters, that wouldn't be a problem. In those days, if you used World War II RG8 cable on 2 meters, they did find that it had quite a bit of extra loss compared to brand new cable of the same diameter. Thank you, Mel.
Yeah, well, that's why they did not use any kind of plastic out. This was a woven out, like a material. Actually, you know, you remember the insulation that they used to use on a lot of wire back even on electric wire in a house, if you remember. It had the rubber that was around the wire, and then at the outside was like that, like a woven type of, made out of, I don't know, what was it made out of? Wool? I have no idea. You know what I'm talking about, Dick? Over.
Yeah, I think in some cases it was cotton. A very sturdy kind of cotton thread was used to make the woven outer cover. Then when they wanted more toughness than that, I imagine the thread was soaked into fancy chemistry before it was woven into the outer cover. Thank you, Mel.
And that's what it was, a thread-like material. I forgot they had a name for that, Dick, over.
Yep, they call it lacing cord. Nowadays, it's made out of nylon, or at least, is it nylon? It melts easily with a soldering iron. And one of the first things I was taught as a electronic technician way back in the early days of the 60s was the fancy knot that you tie. It's basically a clove hitch is one of the basic ways of doing lacing. And there's some other knots they tie, but there's a whole art and science to properly use lacing cord in order to make bundles of cables that stay together correctly. Back to you, Mel.
Roger, that was World War II stuff. You know, there was, I guess there was an art to know how to really do lacing, that it stayed so tight, the bundle. And that's why they used that woven outside and laced it all together and then was installed in the aircraft, I guess, because of its durability once it was put into a bundle. Yeah, it's come a long way. Anyway, okay, get back to a little demonstration tonight. We'll talk about, you know, loss, finding a feed line loss in DB. If you have your Smith chart handy, I know the people that are listening on the scanners, I heard a number of them, they thanked me very much, that they were, a few of them were studying electrical technology, and they went into the classroom, and the teacher was very impressed by the demonstrations, being that they're more or less simple demonstrations, but very effective. So they could, like they said, they could substitute in their own numbers and just use the manipulation. So, okay, let's take, for instance, for this particular demonstration, I got a 50 ohm.